Okay, everyone, so let us continue where we left off yesterday. And we are looking at this famous discourse called the Arya Parayasana Sutta, the Noble Search. And we have been looking at the kind of the right view of the Buddha to be, how he is looking at the world, what actually makes the Buddha to be decided to become a monk, to go forth from the home life to homelessness. And so this is very interesting. And one of the things that we have seen as we've been going through this was that the kind of right view that we're talking about is actually a very simple kind of right view. It's something that we can all relate to. There's nothing profound, there's nothing about dependent origination or the Four Noble Truths. It does relate to the Four Noble Truths, but not the full understanding of these things. And it's a very simple thing here. And I must admit, when I first read this, I realized that actually the reason that we have Buddhism in the world today, the reason we have the Dhamma, is because someone thought about the very simple facts of life in a very kind of profound way. This is why we have the Dhamma today. Someone was reflecting on death, someone reflecting on old age and sickness. We kind of fall under the heading of death in a sense anyway. And someone thought about this in a very deep way. That is why we have the Dhamma today. Buddhism exists simply because of the reflection on dying and death. And that's kind of extraordinary here. Because we all think that we know that we're going to die. We all think that these things are obvious truths of life. And yet we know it, but we don't know it. And this is kind of the paradox here, this paradoxical thing that it's a superficial kind of knowledge. It doesn't really go deep, and that is precisely the problem. So it is worthwhile really contemplating these very simple truths of life, because actually they are very profound in a weird kind of way that we don't really grasp. And then as you reflect on these things, as you use your perception, you develop your perception of this, and you think about it again and again, your mind starts to turn. And you still know exactly the same thing you knew before, but you know it in a deeper way. It is more visceral. You feel it in your bones. And because you feel it in your bones, it means that you act upon these things. As long as it is a superficial view, it doesn't really make us do very much. It doesn't have much effect on our minds. But when it becomes deep, it starts to affect your mind in a very profound way. And you turn in a different direction. Your life takes a different direction as a consequence. So this is what we have been seeing here. Simple realities. The Dhamma is easy. The Dhamma is, the basic ideas are very simple. And I'm always a bit afraid of making it too intellectual, because intellectual things don't really touch us in the same way as the simple things do. The simple things kind of get to the heart of things. You feel them in a way that the intellectual things, you never really feel them. They can be useful, but they don't have the same power to drive us onto the path and make us practice this path in the right way. So I find this very useful. And that is one of the reasons why I spend so much time on this these very simple teachings. So let us finish off the Arya Parayasana Sutta and see what happens at the very end here. So the Buddha has just described the idea of the noble search, the idea of understanding that you are liable to all of these difficulties in life. And because you are liable to all of these difficulties, you understand the problem. You seek the opposite. You seek the freedom from these difficulties. And that is what he has understood. And then the Buddha carries on and he says, mendicants. And whenever you see the word mendicants, you know who the translator is. That is a translator called Bhante Sujato is the translator. He's the only one who translates bhikkhus as mendicants. So, I don't know if you approve of that, but I would say it is a nice translation in my reckoning. But it's, anyway, so there you are. Mendicants, before my awakening, when I was still unawakened but intent on awakening, I too, being liable to be reborn, sought what is also liable to be reborn. Myself liable to grow old, to fall sick, to die, to sorrow, and become corrupted, I sought what is also liable to these things. Then it occurred to me, why do I, being liable to all of these things, seek things that have the same nature? Why don't I seek the freedom from all of these things? The uncorrupted supreme sanctuary, extinguishment. Here the Buddha is saying that he had exactly the same problem before his awakening. Before my awakening, when I was still unawakened but intent on awakening, the word, I always like to point out that the word behind intent on awakening is bodhisatta. Bodhisatta is the same word as bodhisattva in Sanskrit. And usually it is not translated as intent on awakening at all. It is actually translated weirdly. Bodhisatta is translated as bodhisattva. I'm not sure if that is a translation of what it is, but that's often how it is written. But bodhisattva is a kind of person, right? It's a kind of being who makes a vow under some kind of previous Buddha and then decides that I'm going to become awakened myself sometime in the future by practicing all of these paramis and these kind of things. It's kind of a later ideas in Buddhism that actually make themselves felt. And then we read those later ideas into the suttas as if they are there in the suttas, not understanding that actually that would develop much later on. And when you back-read those into the suttas, actually you're doing a disservice to the suttas because you're reading something that is not there. And so the idea is that probably in the suttas it has a different meaning. And this idea of being intent on awakening, to me, is a very nice way of translating bodhisatta. And it's a point that has been made by a number of translators that this is quite possibly the original meaning of this word. Because the idea of a bodhisattva did not actually exist at this time. So it cannot really mean that. It must mean something else. And so the Buddha was intent, or the Buddha-to-be was intent on awakening, right? That makes sense. And from the moment he left the household life, we'll see that in a second, how that happened, until the point of his awakening, that was a time when he was a bodhisattva because he was intent on awakening. That kind of fits in very nicely with how the kind of the life of the Buddha-to-be unfolds according to the suttas. So just making that point, how easy it is to read things into the suttas that are not actually there. And in fact, it is impossible to read the suttas without reading things into them, because we all have our preconditioned ideas in our minds, and it's impossible to kind of get rid of those ideas entirely. But at least we can be alert to this fact, so we can reduce the problem of doing that. So then he thinks, and this is also very interesting. I too, being liable to be reborn, sought what was liable to be reborn. I too, being liable to all of these problems, growing old, falling sick, dying, sorrowing, being corrupted. The Buddha is saying that before his awakening, he had exactly the same problems that we have. And this is kind of my point, one of those very important points, is seeing the humanity of the Buddha to be. He is just like us. There isn't really any big difference. So he was seeking all of these things. And remember the way that seeking was defined just earlier on. It was defined as being attached to these things, tied to these things. That was what seeking means. So the Buddha was also attached and tied to things in the world that are liable to all of these problems, just like we are. And that's kind of beautiful, to know that the Buddha to be, he is just like us. And despite being just like us, having the same problems as we have, he was able to overcome that. If the Buddha could do it, we too can do it. He was able to leave all of these things behind. And that is kind of the message in the suttas, is that the Buddha, before his awakening, he was a person just like us. Yes, he had some very powerful spiritual qualities, but essentially he was like us. Just like we all coming together, we vary in our spiritual qualities. Now, some people here are still practicing the beginning of the path. There are some who are later on the path, and the Buddha was obviously had some powerful qualities, but in essence he was just like us, and he was able to overcome this. And what that means is that we too can do the same thing. And this is the beauty of seeing the Buddha as a human being, seeing him as one of us, if you like, rather than elevating Buddha to something special. If the Buddha is too special, we don't have a relationship with the Buddha anymore. If the Buddha is a human being just like us, then we have an immediate relationship with the Buddha. He is our teacher. He's someone you can talk to. He's someone you can ask advice from. How do you ask advice on the Buddha? You read the suttas. Yeah, you can't really talk to him anymore, unfortunately. But you can read the suttas. So you ask the Buddha for advice, and the Buddha will tell you, well, this is what I did. You should do the same. Yeah, this is what I did. You should do the same. It means that the Buddha, again, is no different from us. When you go around, you read the suttas, and you see all the autobiographical accounts of the Buddha saying, here he had these problems, in other places he had other problems, in terms of wrong views, in terms of defilements, in terms of all of these things. Yeah, and every time the Buddha shows the way out of that, how to practice, what to do. It is obvious that what the Buddha is doing, he's trying to tell us, you should be doing the same thing. And if we then place the Buddha on the wrong kind of pedestal, and we elevate the Buddha to some kind of cosmic principle, some kind of God, something completely beyond what it is to be a normal human being, then these suttas don't talk to us in the same way anymore, because the Buddha is different. And because the Buddha is different, his practice would also have to be different. And that is the wrong way of looking at it. And that's why it is so important that we understand the Buddha in the right way. The Buddha is a human being. We can relate to the Buddha. It's like coming to Ajahn Brahm and asking Ajahn Brahm a question. In the same way, you can ask the Buddha a question in exactly the same way. And he will talk to you, and he will tell you, and you will say, thank you so much for showing me the way. And you will practice accordingly, and then you get the same results. So the Buddha here, yeah, liable to the same thing, to being infatuated, tied and attached, just like we are. He had a wife maybe, or a partner at least, and he had a child, and he had all of these trappings of the world, yeah, all the animals and all of that. He lived in quite a well-off family. He did not live in a palace, by the way. That's kind of a later additions. But he was well-off, according to the suttas. And of course, these are the trappings of life. They are called trappings because they trap you. And that is precisely the problem. So, the Buddha was all of these things. He also could become corrupted, yeah? The defilements could arise. But then, and this is what makes the Buddha different, or the Buddha to be different, it occurred to me, why do I, being liable to all of these things, seek the same things? I already have a problem, and then I go out and kind of multiply that problem by attaching to things that have the same issue as I have. Why don't I instead seek the freedom from the born, the freedom from old age, the freedom from illness, the freedom from dying, the freedom from sorrow, the freedom from corruption, the supreme sanctuary extinguishment? And this is where the Buddha to be is different from most people. Yeah, he dares to kind of look beyond the ordinary problems of the world. He dares to ask the questions that are really never asked by anyone. No one says, yeah, I'm going to seek the solution to death. Yeah, it's this kind of incredible audacity. Of course, it helps to live in a culture where these questions were already asked, where there were already samanas, there were ascetics, there were monastics doing these kind of things. And of course, that helps because it shows that there is a way out of this. But here in Australia, if you say, I'm going to go off into the bush and find a solution to death, it sounds like you're nuts, yeah? It sounds like you're completely crazy, because no one else would do that. So here it doesn't really work. But in that ancient society in India, there was already a tendency in that direction. And then the Buddha says, I will find this solution. I'm going to strive for this. And this is then what happens afterwards, the continuation of the biography of the Buddha, where he does look for the solution to things that seem like they have no solution. How can you find a solution to death? That's crazy. Everyone has to die. What does it mean to find a solution to death? But of course, that is exactly what the Buddha finds. And that is why this is what makes the Buddha so extraordinary. So what does it take to have that kind of audacity? That kind of willingness to try the seemingly impossible. What does it take? And what it takes, of course, it takes powerful spiritual qualities. And this is the thing that you can see in the suttas, in the life of the Buddha. He talks about his spiritual qualities. He had a degree of wisdom. He had a degree of faith. He had a degree of energy that was very unusual. He did things that most people are not capable of doing. So in his past lives, he must have been already been leaning in the right direction, developing good qualities, not because he was a bodhisattva, but merely this is what happens in the world. Some people are more spiritually developed, other ones are less spiritually developed. And he was among those who were the most spiritually developed. And that's why when he came into this life, he had those qualities that enabled him to be really audacious and try to seek for the seemingly impossible. So we should be doing the same thing here. And as we develop our spiritual qualities, we too become more audacious. We dare to look at the world in a new way. We dare to do things differently. Why? Because we have a sense of confidence about ourselves. The people who are very confident about themselves in the world tend to be people who have very strong spiritual qualities. Confidence can also come from all kind of stupid things like a big ego and that sort of thing, but that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the natural confidence that arises without an ego, without being narcissistic or anything like that. But the natural confidence that comes to people, a beautiful kind of confidence, a feeling of security within yourself, a feeling of independence, a feeling that you can do it. That kind of confidence comes from spiritual qualities. That's what we should all be developing. So he says, why don't I seek these things, right? And then he says, sometime later, while still black-haired, blessed with youth in the prime of life, though my mother and father wished otherwise, weeping with tearful faces, I shaved off my hair and beard, dressed in the ochre robes, and went forth from the lay life to homelessness. So here we have right intention. Right? We have been looking at right view all the way, understanding the world as it is. And from that right view comes the right intention. And the right intention is then to practice the path. And for the Buddha to be, that meant going forth to be able to practice it fully. So right intention arises from right view. Why? Because when you see the world in a certain way, when you then, of course, you act upon that view. Yeah, that's just the way life is. Whatever views you have, you act upon those views. If you think that happiness is going to be found in whatever, in relationships, well then all likelihood you will have a relationship. That's kind of how things are. If you think happiness is going to be found in monastic life, well then maybe you become a monastic. We're always driven by our views. Our views always lead to intentions and aims and purposes in our life. Our worldview is what determines how we live our lives. So the Buddha then goes forth, and that's why I stop at this point, because here we are kind of coming to the end of right view, and I want to carry on with right views. So that's why I kind of have all the dots there. So, but before I move on to the next sutta, just it's worthwhile contemplating a little bit more about what is going on here. The Buddha says, while still black-haired, blessed with youth. And of course the idea is that we want to grasp the view, the problems of life as soon as possible. The younger you are, the greater the chance is that you will be able to fulfill the practice, because it is quite, it takes a long time to change your views, to change your mind. And if you wait too long with going forth, there is less chance that you will be able to practice the path fully. So going forth when you are young is always kind of praised in the suttas. Black haired, you don't wait till those gray hairs appear. Sometimes you do. I love this kind of little suttas that you find somewhere. This is a, it's called the Makadeva Sutta, I think. Makadeva was some kind of king who lived for 84,000 years or whatever. It's a beautiful little sutta. It's kind of, these are like more like stories and narratives, but it's found in the suttas. So they are kind of, it's kind of very endearing here. And this king lived for 84,000 years, and the kind of the first 20,000 he was young, and the second 20,000 he was kind of working hard, and then the third he was kind of whatever. It's kind of dividing up the world in this way. Yeah. And then he goes to his barber, yeah, when he's still young, and he says, "Barber, when you see a gray hair on my head, I want you to let me know. Please tell me when you see gray hair on my head." So then after 20,000 years, yeah, the same barber for 20,000 years. It's kind of interesting. And so the barber, "Sir, yeah, your majesty, I have seen a gray hair on your head." And so the king says, "Well, pluck it out." And so the barber gets the tweezers, yeah, and it pulls out the gray hair and shows it to the king. And the king says, "Right, okay, that is the Devaduta, the messenger of the devas. Now the time has come for me to hand over the kingdom to my sons." It was always the sons. "And hand over to the sons, and I will go forth from the home life to homelessness." Yeah, the gray hair is kind of a divine messenger that tell you you are on the way out. Yeah, the first sign, the very first gray hair, and that's it. Now you are kind of going to go forth. And it's kind of beautiful. Yeah, these were very, very powerful kings. This idea of the Makadeva, who was a king who lived for 84,000 years and had a vast kingdom and had everything they wanted, still they recognize the limits of ordinary life. It's not about whether ordinary life, whether you are a king or whether you are, you know, homeless sleeping under a bridge, that's kind of irrelevant. The problems of life are still exactly the same. The attachments, the sorrow, the grief, the death, all of these things are still there. And that is kind of the point. And you recognize that regardless of how good a life you have as a layperson. So it's kind of, it's nice, yeah. But the Buddha to be, yeah, even before he has got the first gray hair, still he goes forth. And then this little, tiny little phrase that actually is quite interesting. And he says, "Though my mother and father wished otherwise, weeping with tearful faces." And this is a kind of important little phrase, because especially for many people, when we know the biography of the Buddha, the standard biography of the Buddha is the idea that, you know, he decided to go forth in the middle of the night. His wife and his son are kind of sleeping, right? And then in the middle of the night, without telling anyone, he gets on his horse, the horse, the Kantaka, and then he rides out of the city, yeah, jumps over the city walls and this magnificent capital called Kapilavati with millions of people or whatever, and he kind of flies over the wall. It's very romantic and very, sounds more like a Hollywood movie than kind of real life, yeah? And of course, that is because it is like a Hollywood movie, because it is a myth, it is a legend, it is not actually what happened. And this shows us the importance of distinguishing between the early suttas, what is the word of the Buddha, and what is later mythology and legend, the developed idea of the Buddha's life. And it is important because it seems kind of callous. It seems hard-hearted. Yeah, you just leave your family just like that without telling anyone. You just kind of go. Is that okay? And it doesn't sound, I mean, people who are Buddhist, of course, we will forgive the Buddha. We will say he had a much bigger, you know, kind of larger outlook in the world, and so it is kind of okay. And maybe it is okay, but it still seems kind of wrong. Why wouldn't you talk to your family first? Why wouldn't you say, "Well, can I be sure that my wife and child will be looked after?" Yeah, in those days, wives and children were much more dependent on the husband or whatever than maybe they are these days. And so wouldn't that be a natural thing? And it would be a natural thing for anyone who was responsible. And of course, that is what you find in the suttas. Yeah, the mother and father wished otherwise. He had obviously been speaking to his family. Yeah, this is what we see here. So in the suttas, the story is different sometimes, what we find in the later biography of the Buddha. And often there are actually meaningful differences, such as here, which kind of makes the whole thing seem much more reasonable. And I think that sometimes these little things, actually, they make a difference. I know that there are kind of Christian missionaries that go around saying, yeah, the Buddha, he was really kind of, he didn't really look after his, he was irresponsible, he didn't look after his children, you know. And if you say that to someone who hasn't really thought much about this, maybe think, oh, yeah, that's a good point, yeah. Maybe the Buddha wasn't as enlightened as I thought he was. Okay, maybe I should become a Christian instead. And this is how people think, right? This is kind of the reality. But this is actually what happened. So then, after consulting with his family, making sure that everyone was okay, then he shaves off his hair and beard, dresses in the ochre robes, a bit like this, and goes forth from the lay life to homelessness. Right intention. There you are. That is the Arya Pariyasana Sutta for you. And now we're going to leave this sutta behind. It goes on for a long time. It's a very beautiful sutta. And if you want to read the whole thing, I would really recommend it, Majjhimanikaya 26, because there's so much powerful Dhamma in that sutta. But now I want to keep on looking at the idea of right view, the very first factor of the Noble Eightfold Path, and so I'm going to leave that sutta for now. So we're going to move on with more aspects of right view. I'm going to look at another sutta, which I have been talking about quite a bit in recent times, which I think might be just briefly we're going to go through. And this is the Atta Danda Sutta. And Atta Danda, Danda means like punishment or sticks or violence or something like that. And Atta means something like taking it up, employing these kind of things. So this is like taking up of violence or taking up of punishment is what this really means. And this particular sutta is from the Sutta Nipata, the Attakavaka, the chapter of 8. There's some very nice suttas in there. Maybe we should look more at those suttas on some future retreat, because they have a slightly different feeling to them than many of the other suttas you may have heard or read. So it may be interesting to look at those. And this is more about right view. This is more about how the Buddha-to-be was thinking before his going forth, or during his period of going forth, before his awakening or whatever. And so it gives us more insight into how to think about things. What is that drives you onto the spiritual path? What is it that enables you to leave the world a little bit behind? Understand that the world just isn't all that interesting. There are far more interesting things in life than the worldly things. And of course, these are precisely the spiritual things in life. So, what does the Buddha have to say? And this is what he has to say. Peril stems from those who take up arms. Just look at people in conflict. I shall extol how I came to be stirred with a sense of urgency. Maybe I'll just read out the whole poem, actually, because it's kind of nice to get the full thing, and then we can go back and we can look in details afterwards. I saw this population flounder like a fish in a little puddle. Seeing them fight each other, fear came upon me. The world around was hollow. All directions were in turmoil. Wanting a home for myself, I saw nowhere unsettled. Yet even in the settlement they fight. Seeing that, I grew uneasy. Then I saw a dart there, so hard to see, stuck in the heart. When stuck by that dart, you run around in all directions. But when that same dart has been plucked out, you neither run around nor sink down. And then comes the training that follows from this. This is kind of the right view part. And then comes the training that comes once you have that right view. Whatever attachments there are in the world, don't pursue them. Having pierced through sensual pleasures in every way, train yourself for quenching. Be truthful, not rude, free of deceit and rid of slander. Without anger, a sage would cross over the evils of greed and avarice, prevail over sleepiness, sloth, and drowsiness. Don't abide in negligence. A person intent on quenching would not stand for arrogance. Don't be led into lying or get caught up in fondness for form. Completely understand conceit and desist from hasty conduct. Don't relish the old or welcome the new. Don't grieve for what is running out or get attached to things that pull you in. Greed, I say, is the great flood, and longing is the current, the basis, the compulsion, the swamp of sensuality so hard to get past. A sage never strays from the truth. A Brahmin stands firm on the shore. Having given up everything, they are said to be at peace. So now we are moving on to the result of the path, right? So first of all, you have the right view, then you have the practice, and then you have the result, which is the arahant. Yeah, so kind of you can see the stages of the sutta. They have truly known, they are a knowledge master, understanding the teacher, they are independent. They rightly proceed in the world, not coveting anything here. One who has crossed over sensuality here, the snare in the world so hard to get past, grieves not nor hopes. They've cut the strings, they're no longer bound. What came before, let it wither away, and after, let there be nothing. If you don't grasp at the middle, you will live at peace. One who has no sense of ownership in the realm of name and form does not grieve for that which is not. They suffer no loss in the world. If you don't think of anything as belonging to yourself or others, not finding anything to be mine, you won't grieve, thinking, I don't have it. Not bitter, not fawning, unstirred, everywhere even. When asked about one who is unshakable, I declare that is the benefit. For the unstirred who understand, there is no performance of deeds. Desisting from instigation, they see sanctuary everywhere. A sage doesn't speak of themselves as being among superiors, inferiors, or equals. Peaceful, rid of stinginess, they neither take nor reject. So, there you are. This is the Attadanda Sutta. And straight away you can see that when we're dealing with verse, we are dealing with things that are a bit more not as clear, right? The idea here is more to inspire people and to kind of talk about things in a poetic way. And when it's poetry, it's kind of more interpretative. We have to interpret this to try to understand what is going on. And this kind of makes poetry more interesting. And one of the things that we shall see later on this retreat is that when it comes to poetry, often many interpretations are allowed. You can see things from different angles. But remember that even though many interpretations are allowed, it doesn't mean that any interpretation is allowed. There are always wrong interpretations. And this is a very important point to make. It doesn't mean that you can just kind of freely choose how to interpret things. So there are vastly more wrong interpretations than there are right interpretations. But there may still be a number of right interpretations. So let us start from the beginning here. So peril stems from those who take up arms. Just look at people in conflict. Peril here, bhaya, means like danger or fear. And when people take up arms, again, arms here is danda, is like punishment, or violence. So when people are violent, there is fear, there is danger. Just look at people in conflict. This is kind of obvious. You might say, of course, when there is violence in the world, people see the danger, they see the fear in that. No one really wants violence. Everyone wants to live in peace. And yet the world somehow is quite violent. You just read the news and you see the violence going on in various places. And of course, the point here, and this is what becomes more clear further down, is that it is inherent to the world, the idea of violence. There is no world without violence. Or at least there is no sensory world without violence. As long as we live in the sensory realm, as long as we live among sensual pleasures, violence is inherent to that kind of existence. And that is really the point here. Yeah, and that is why that world is always going to be fearful, always going to be problematic, always going to be troublesome. And there is one very beautiful sutta that talks about this in a really nice way. And this is the Sakkapanya Sutta, the questions of Sakka found in the Digha Nikaya, the long discourse of the Buddha number 21. And in that sutta, the king of the gods, the Devinda, the lord of the gods, Sakka, he comes down to the Buddha. And he asks the Buddha, says to the Buddha, can I please ask you some questions? It's another very interesting sutta. There's all kind of weird stuff in that sutta. And maybe we should read it out one day because it's kind of really, it's good fun, some of these things. But we are too serious now to get into the good fun, so we better stick to the serious things. But maybe one day when we kind of are more in a jolly mood, we can kind of read out that sutta. We'll see what happens. So in that sutta, Sakka approaches the Buddha and he says to the Buddha, well, may I please ask a question? And then the Buddha says, please, he doesn't say fire away, but he says something. It's too, maybe a bit too violent kind of metaphor. Yes, please. And then Sakka says, and this is a really kind of nice question. It's a question when I saw it, I thought, wow, this is really sharp. Yeah, this is kind of the question I would like to ask as well, if it had occurred to me to ask this kind of question. And he says, what he says is this, why is it that even though everyone in the world wants to live in peace, wants to live in harmony, wants to live in a society where everyone is kind of gets along and there are no problem, why is that when everyone wants this, still we live in a society where there is violence, where there is conflict, where there's so many problems? Yeah, when we desire all of these good things, how come that still we live in societies that are problematic? And it's a very, very good question. Yeah, and I thought, wow, this is really, really well taken. So, why is it? And then the Buddha gives this beautiful explanation. And as often, the Buddha looks at this and it kind of traces back the causes, right? So what the first cause, I can't remember now exactly how the sequence goes, but it's about desire and aversion, right? And it's about these kind of things. Because we desire things in the world, we end up in conflict with others. And then it traces it back stage by stage. And the root cause, the root problem why there is violence in the world, even though we want to live in peace and harmony, is because, he says, papancha sanya sankha, I think the word is there. And papancha sanya sankha, really what this means, it means the sense of self. As long as there is a sense of self there, as long as we are driven by this sense of self inside, that is what is the root cause of violence in the world. Because the sense of self sets up us against others. The sense of self is greedy. The sense of self is where maybe we want to harm other people. The sense of self is the root problem of everything really in existence, according to the Buddhist teachings. Also, the idea of violence and problem and conflict in the world. And once you get that, once you see that this must be true, because actually, if you think about it, actually it kind of makes very good sense. Once you see that, you realize there is no escape from suffering in the world. Why? Because everyone almost has a sense of self. And those people who don't have a sense of self, well, they will get parinibbana anyway. They will be gone before long, and the rest of us will remain, all those who have a sense of self. So the sense of self is kind of a given in our society. And because the sense of self is a given, violence, conflict, problems, wars, Russia invading Ukraine, right? All of these things are not really surprising at all. We should expect Russia to invade Ukraine. When you saw Russia invading Ukraine, did you think, oh yeah, I expected that? Or did you think, oh no, they're invading. How come they're invading each other? What's going on here? Now the wise person would say, oh yeah, I expected that. But it's kind of hard to be that wise, right? It's difficult. There are very few such wise people in the world. I think if I asked Ajahn Brahm, and he might say, oh yeah, of course Russia is invading Ukraine. Yeah, that's to be expected. Of course, New Zealand is invading Australia. Now that is really unlikely. I have to admit, I can't really see that happening. It's tiny little islands down there. But maybe China could invade Australia, right? That is at least possible because a very powerful country. Yeah. Or maybe the United States invades Australia. I don't know. You become enemies with the U.S. Suddenly, kind of things go wrong. Yeah. I don't know. Weird things happen in the world, right? And what the only thing that is sure, there will be violence one way or another. That is the one certainty. Exactly how it happens, exactly how it turns out, well, that is actually very difficult to say. But that there is violence, that is a given. And once you see that, yeah, it turns you off the world. If the world of the five senses, if it is inherent in that world to be violent, it means that you will always be a bit fearful. You always be kind of, okay, what happens if you are in the war zone? Would you like to live in Ukraine right now when it gets invaded? What does it feel like to living in Ukraine? Well, we are all Ukrainians in a certain way, because we have all been there before. And it may not happen in this life right now, here in Australia, but maybe it will. But if it doesn't happen in this life, it will happen in future lives. We're all part of this. It is not something that you can escape. And once you see that conflict, wars, all of these things are inherent to the five-sense world, it makes the five-sense world so much less interesting. Yeah, there is no utopia. There is no way of creating a society that always will be peaceful, always will be right, always will function according to how we want it to function. The idea of a utopia, yeah, a kind of stable, perfect society, this is not the Buddhist idea at all. Buddhism is the exact opposite. Things are always changing. Things are always being undermined by the sense of self, being undermined by our defilements. No stability can be found in the world in the kind of social the way we structure our societies or whatever. Yeah. And so this is the idea here. This is why the Buddha to be becomes fearful. This is why he becomes stirred with a sense of urgency, because he sees the nature of life, the nature of existence. There are other similar kind of similes in the suttas would make the same point. But let me just stop there, because you can't say everything on one retreat, so we'll just leave it at that. So he says, look at people in conflict. I shall extol how I came to be stirred with a sense of urgency, right? That urgency arises because you understand the problem of the world. I saw this population flounder. The word here can also mean something like agitated. You saw the population being agitated, like a fish in a little puddle. A fish in a puddle is obviously going to be fearful. It's going to thrash about, trying to escape. In the same way, the population in the world is kind of agitated, always trembling in the world because of all of the uncertainty. Fear and anxiety is part of the human condition. Everyone can expect some degree of fear and anxiety in their life. Why? Precisely because the world is so uncertain, so unreliable. And our sense of self doesn't want that. It doesn't want that unreliability and uncertainty. So this is part of life. It's like a fish in a little puddle. And what is that little puddle? Well, that little puddle is the world. The world is like a little puddle. And it may feel to us like the world is like a big place, because you can travel around, you can go to various places. Even just traveling around Australia, it seems like a big puddle already. It takes 4 hours by plane to get to Sydney. It's a kind of a big place, Australia. But it is a little puddle in the sense that you cannot escape from the violence, you cannot escape from the conflict by traveling. Humanity is the same everywhere. If you go to Europe, you go to China, or you go to the Americas, or you go to Africa, the human condition is the same. You cannot escape this by traveling in the world. The way to escape this is by traveling inwards, within yourself. That is where the escape from these things can be found. The world is largely the same. The world is largely not very interesting. Yeah, because the problems are the same everywhere. What's the point of going somewhere else when the problems are exactly the same? Yeah, maybe you want to go somewhere to kind of see something interesting, but what really, why is it very interesting? It isn't all that interesting when you know that the underlying concerns, the underlying problems are exactly the same. What does it matter whether you eat Chinese food or French food? Right? But this is what people live for. Yeah, I'm going to have, okay, but the best food, go to Hong Kong. Hong Kong is said to have really nice food, right? So you go to Hong Kong to eat kind of Hong Kong food, or you go to some kind of French master chef in Paris, or whatever you do. Or you, yeah, but actually, they're just variations on the theme, and the underlying problems are still exactly the same. And you stop seeking for the stupidity, the small little things in that realm, when you know that the big issues are exactly the same. So, yeah. So you flounder like a fish in a little puddle, seeing people fight each other. Yeah, and this is kind of life, fighting each other. Fear came upon me. Yeah. And fighting happens on so many levels. It happens between nations. It happens in our, between small groups. It happens within groupings, like within the Buddhist society. Sometimes maybe we get a bit heated even within the Buddhist society sometimes. It happens within the family, and sometimes it happens even within ourselves. We may be fighting with ourselves sometimes. It's kind of weird, isn't it? And we kind of get have ill will towards ourselves, and we get depressed and all these kind of things. So it's kind of everywhere, on all different levels, you find this problem. The world around was hollow. The idea that all directions are in turmoil. The idea of hollow is that there is nothing to hold on to. There's nothing substantial in the world. There's nowhere you can find a refuge. Everything is just in turmoil. Turmoil here is just another word for anicca, impermanence, unreliability, uncertainty. There's nothing to hold on to in the world because everything is always moving around, changing. And despite the fact that everything is changing, you want a home for yourself, yeah? Wanting a home for myself. I saw nowhere unsettled. And the idea here of unsettled seemed to mean that it is unsettled by impermanence, unsettled by suffering, unsettled by the problems in life. There is no place you can make a home, because wherever you make a home, these problems in the world, they're going to catch up with you regardless of what you do. And that's kind of unpleasant, isn't it? Why do we have a home? Why do we have a place that we kind of hang out, where we like to be? Well, the reason is because a home provides a shelter. This is a very important part of having a home. It's a shelter from the world. Yeah, you lock your front door and you go into your home and you have a sense of security. And then you enjoy yourself, you make nice food, you have some nice entertainment or whatever. That is what the home life is supposed to be like. Shelter from the world combined with the enjoyment of the world. And so home life is supposed to provide that. But does it really provide it? And it doesn't. Yeah, the uncertainty is still there, the underlying uncertainty, the bushfires right here in Perth, the wars in Ukraine, and suddenly your house is demolished. It doesn't exist anymore. And that is very, very painful for people, precisely because a home is a very important place for us. So there is nowhere to find a real home. And so what does that mean? Well, it means we need to seek for the home elsewhere. And this is kind of interesting, because there is such a thing as a home, but you have to know where to look for it. And, of course, the answer to the real home is the idea of going inwards, of going into the meditation practice, finding the peace and the joy within. And when you have access to that inner happiness, the inner joy, which is the freedom from the uncertain world outside, that is where you find your real home. And this was also said by Ajahn Chah, Ajahn Brahm's teacher in Thailand. Yeah, he talks about the real home. The real home is within. It is found in samadhi. It is found in meditation practice. Why? Because there you can find relief from the world. You're no longer susceptible to all the troubles, the violence, the uncertainty of the world. You have a refuge within. And that refuge is a secure one, at least for a while. Yeah, because the world cannot touch you there. So this is the idea, moving away from the uncertain world and finding the refuge somewhere else. And this is what you find in the suttas, in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, the greatest sutta on the Buddha's passing away. This is a point the Buddha makes very specifically. Find the refuge in the four satipatthanas in the meditation practice. And then he says that even if you try to settle, yeah, even in the settlement, the fight, here the word settlement is used a little bit differently from the previous sentence. So you try to settle, and yet even when you try to settle, you keep on fighting. Yeah. And seeing that, I grew uneasy. Yeah. And the word here behind uneasy is arati, and it means basically that you become dissatisfied. Yeah, you are not satisfied with that world anymore because you understand it is inherently problematic. Yeah. So the Buddha has seen the problem. He has seen the suffering. He has seen that there is an issue. And then the next thing he sees is that, actually the Buddha to be, I should say, then I saw a dart there, so hard to see, stuck in the heart. And that dart that is stuck in the heart, that is so hard to see, that, of course, is the dart of craving. And now the Buddha is going from seeing the problem to seeing the cause of the problem. The cause of the problem is the craving that drives us on in that sensory world. Even though it is so problematic, we crave for it. We are craving for suffering. That's basically what the Buddha is saying. It is hard to see, and one of the reasons why it is hard to see is because we tend to enjoy that craving. We tend to identify even with the craving in the world. And of course, if you enjoy whatever you enjoy, whatever you identify with, it's very difficult to see as a problem. That is why it is so hard to see. When struck by that dart, you run around in all directions. Yeah, you are the slave of craving, driven around, ever restless, ever agitated. But when that same dart has been plucked out, when craving comes to an end, you neither run down nor do you sink down. You stop running around because there is nowhere to go anymore. There's nothing really of interest in that world. Nor do you sink down. Sometimes when we crave a lot and we don't get the outcome that we want from that craving, you may become depressed or sad or despondent or whatever. You don't sink down either. So removing craving is not some kind of terrible state of boredom. Yeah, sometimes you might think that, well, if I don't crave anything, it will be really boring. What am I going to do? I'm just going to sit there yawning and sleeping all day or something. Yeah. That is not the point. The point is that if you remove craving in the right way through the path, actually it is the opposite. It elevates you. It lifts you up. You become bright and clear and incredibly happy. That is the purpose here. This is kind of what where it leads to. So you don't sink down. You do the opposite. And you gain the beautiful, bright, clear mind full of wisdom. That is what you actually get. So the Buddha talks about the problem, then about the removing of the problem, right? Which is taking out that dart. So you can see the first three noble truths being talked about here. The dukkha, the problem, the cause of the problem, and then the removal of the problem. Or removal of the cause, which then also sorts out the problem. And then, of course, the next thing is then about the path. So the next part here now, we're going to talk about the path. So I will talk about that. Just start out. We have a few minutes left, so I will start out talking about that. So you neither sink, you neither run around or sink down. And then the training comes. Whatever attachments there are in the world, don't pursue them. Yeah, the Pali word for attachment here, I think, is gadita. So these are the things that you hold on to. Whatever things that there are to be held on to in the world, actually, they're not worth pursuing. Because if you pursue them, you still become part of that realm of violence and conflict, just like you were before. So you no longer you lose your interest in that. You move away from those things. Having pierced through sensual pleasures or the sensual objects, if you like, in every way, having understood the problems of the sensual realm, you train yourself for quenching. Quenching here is nibbana. Yeah, it is the extinguishment, the extinguishing of the fire within, the fire that drives you on in the sensory realm. Be truthful, not rude. Yeah. So here we are looking at the path of practice. Be free of deceit. Yeah. Present yourself as you are to the world. Don't present yourself in a false way. Be honest about who you are. Be rid of slander. Yeah. This negative way of speaking, without anger. A sage would cross over the evils of greed and avarice. The word for evil here is papa. Papa is like bad, yeah, bad or evil. The sage crosses over the evils of greed and avarice. It is like you have, almost like you have to be a sage to cross over these things, because they are so very deeply embedded in the human mind that only a sage is really able to do this. Once you overcome this, once you attain samadhi, you are already considered like a sage in Buddhism. A lot of the people in the world who attain deep samadhi, they are kind of different. Yeah, they don't really, when you look at them, they seem to be different from what we are like, or most ordinary people are like. Prevail over sleepiness, sloth, and drowsiness. Don't abide in negligence. The person intent on quenching would not stand for arrogance. Yeah, so again, the idea of overcoming the sleepiness, sloth, and drowsiness. This is again done by giving rise to energy instead, and also by overcoming the sensual realm, because the sensual realm is also a realm of sloth and drowsiness. And so by overcoming that, you're overcoming these kind of issues. And you don't abide in negligence. Pamada is the word here. You are careful. You are circumspect. You have yoniso manasikara. This is wise attention. Yeah, you look at the world carefully. And you make wise choices based on that careful observation on the world. This is the opposite of negligence. The person intent on quenching would not stand for arrogance. Arrogance means a overestimation of yourself, arrogance is a kind of stupidity. You're arrogant because fascinating, when you really do become a superior person, if you are a noble one, and this is what I call the superior people in the Dhamma, someone who has seen the Dhamma properly, actually that whole idea of arrogance becomes completely, just disappears. Why? Because you understand the nature of the self and how it is constructed, how there is no real thing there. And so, of course, you cannot become arrogant anymore. So arrogance is a sign of delusion. Arrogance is a sign of stupidity. We haven't really understood the nature of the world, the nature of ourselves and the mind and all of these kind of things. Okay, so I will stop there just in the middle of the sutta, and we shall continue with that this afternoon at 3 o'clock. We can come back again and carry on. In the meantime, please keep on enjoying yourself. So have a nice lunch, then we will see what happens later on. Okay.